The Falling Middle Cast is a spin-off series from the creators of Mars on Life. This series provides review and commentary of Barbara Ehrenreich's Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class. Since this series analyzes the text and provides a critique on class in America, this is not a comprehensive audiobook and follows all copyright claims. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to talking about socioeconomic differences and I guess what makes you rich and what makes you poor. Sorry, you caught me at an inopportune time. I was busy bathing in the luxuries that be in a first world country. So
you were verklempt over the possibility of this going past this book and potentially another Ehrenreich book.
You know, at this point, I'm just about ready.
Uh-oh.
To dial back my responses to a D&D dice. So any question you ask me, I'm just going to roll for initiative. Oh, look at that, 5. I'll put a modest amount of effort. If I were to roll a 1.
Fingernails. Good lord.
What's wrong with my fingernails?
You look like Bob Dylan. Like, what, are you playing guitar? Like,
yeah, actually. I used to play bass. Don't you look stupid. Anyway.
Hey, I just trimmed my nails, my guy.
Hey, man, I picked up on hobbies in quarantine, unlike you.
Oh,
so the new right and the new class. I'm going to get some water because that bit kind of went on for a little bit longer than I anticipated. But yeah, any question you ask me, I'll refer to the D&D dice. I'll roll for initiative. Any lower numbers, I won't give a shit in my response. And higher numbers, I'll try to be as in-depth as a term paper would. So you have a scale here. You either have USC School of Medicine or you have Breitbart.
Welcome, listeners, to the Falling Middle Cast. I am Ryan Mancini, and my co-host today is Harvey Dent. Harvey Dent, how's it going?
Introduce a little anarchy. This is where I'd have, like, my cap gun since I was 6.
If you're Harvey Dent, shouldn't you also, you could also just answer all your questions by going, like Tommy Lee Jones, as he walks away. I'm assuming he's got a coin with a scarred side to it, or a scratched up side. Oh, good lord.
Yeah, of course, man.
Wait, who's on that coin? I think I recognized it. Any Massachusetts resident would recognize it.
Yeah, his head's still intact, but, you know. There you go. The neoconservatives were, and still are, a small group of intellectuals absorbed with their journals, institutes, and conferences. Oh, what a world where we believe that. Then the TV came about, people. The New Right was a movement, or would-be movement, with potential constituents scattered in dozens of single-issue group and fundamentalist Christian denominations. Within the New Right, the neoconservatives have never been entirely trusted. They are too urban, too self-consciously intellectual, and no doubt too likely to be Jewish. That just hit me like a fucking left hook, I'm sorry. What? God, Ehrenreich, man, I would have loved to meet her. But the intellectual leadership of the New Right has not hesitated to crib its ideas from the neoconservatives, and the most important of these was the idea of the new class. With the ascent of the New Right in the 80s, the idea of the new class emerged from the airy realm of thought to become part of the rationale for actual policy. Policies directed, however, not against the new class or anything resembling it, but against the poor. By the New Right's own reckoning, it was born in 1974, when 4 relatively young organizations based in the Washington area, the Conservative Caucus, RAVCO, the direct mail funding company run by Richard Viguerie.
Yeah.
The Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress, now the Free Congress Political Action Committee, and the National Conservative Political Action Committee began systematically coordinating their activities. The money came from wealthy right-wingers such as Joseph Kors and Richard Mellon Scaife, as well as from hundreds of thousands of individuals solicited by Ravco and other organizations. And it came in great quantities. By the late 70s, the new right was already a highly bureaucratic, top-heavy effort and a haven, inevitably, for legions of middle-class intellectuals, administrators, and political experts. It had its own think tanks, of which the Heritage Foundation is the best known. Mm. Its own... Care to speak up, class? Its own periodicals, such as the Conservative Digest. Oh, no moan there? Okay. And an expanding network of sympathetic or subsidiary groups, pro-business, anti-gun control, pro-law and order, and pro-family. In 1979, the secular leaders of the New Right instigated the formation of a right-wing religious membership organization, the Moral Majority, and thereby eventually gained a following among white Protestant fundamentalists. A year later, they helped elect their favorite candidate, except possibly for Jesse Helms, to the presidency of the United States.
She basically just put a couple thousand pages worth of Rick Perlstein's four texts on the conservative movement and boiled it down to like two pages for the most part.
Hmm, hold on
or
a second.
At the very least, I mean, let me look at the other page. Yeah, at least two pages so far. So, here, although it keeps going a little bit, handful here of pages. So,
here, hold on. Two. That's cool. Anyway. Ideologically, the New Right could be considered the scrappy progeny of two very dissimilar men. Barry Goldwater, who came to national prominence as the conservative Republican presidential candidate in 1964, and George Wallace. Goldwater contributed the traditional conservative themes, militarism, anti-communism, and the need to shrink the role of government to make way for truly free enterprise, yet ironically making it more bureaucratic than it had to be. That's my comment. But the men who created the New Right recognize that traditional conservatism, especially on economic issues, has an inherently limited appeal. If the right was to move beyond its blue blood constituency and tuxedoed image, it would have to follow the trail Wallace had blazed into America's smokestack cities and blue-collar suburbs. It would need new issues. And if it was to successfully mobilize the resentments of middle America, it would need an enemy. The New Right found its first new issues in the backlash themes exploited by Wallace and more successfully by Agnew. Opposition to school busing and to textbooks, perceived as overly liberal, had created, in scattered localities, angry constituencies of middle Americans, which the New Right did its best to cultivate. In the early 70s, the emergence of a mass feminist movement opened up additional targets for the right. The Equal Rights Amendment, which had sailed through Congress in 1972, and abortion, which was decriminalized by the Supreme Court in 73. In the late 70s, in its effort to court Protestant fundamentalists, the New Right enlarged its concerns to include opposition to gay rights, opposition to the teaching of evolution and sex education, and advocacy for the restoration of organized prayer in the public schools. I always wondered why that was. I used to have a political science class where it was strictly debate only. You would write your paper in this asinine way. I can't even begin to tell you how asinine these papers were written. It was like 10-point font, single space, like you had to fill front and back sides of the page, and then you had to bring that to class in order to use those as talking points to debate.
Was this for college or high school?
This was for college.
I think we've had a conversation about this professor in class long before Mars on Life.
This professor had it was a man.
Oh.
And let's just say that his letter was a Greek symbol, or his name was a Greek symbol. Yep. So one of the first arguments that we had to have in class was the whole creationism versus evolution argument. And on it, obviously, I know your opinion on it, but I hate, here's the thing about me, listeners, in case it wasn't obvious. I hate having to delve into something that, while I don't necessarily have an inherent bias towards one way or the other, I'm just looking at it as like, show me the facts and logic that you conservatives love to tout. And as much as I like to believe that faith has its place in commonality and having something to believe in, like, you're not going to teach evolution, or you're not going to preface it over that book that you hold so high in regard. I think it's safe to say that after billions and billions of years of evolution, we've kind of had a consensus on how the Earth physically came to be, as well as all the life beings on it. But I feel like the see lazy option is not the, oh, hey, this is how single-celled organisms grew into multi-celled organisms. Like, that doesn't seem like the see lazy option. The see lazy option is man in the sky.
Right.
It just makes me wonder how like fundamentalists can't bother to see it any other way besides that, or at least have like a mix of the two, or I don't know, maybe separate church and state.
Well, then they wouldn't be fundamentalists. It's that simple.
I don't see the harm in just being fundamentalists on your own personal dime, though.
What do you mean? Like keeping the fundamentalism at home?
Yeah. Like if you practice fundamentalism, or any religion for that matter, either you would do it in the own personal spirituality that you, and again, I'm not trying to make this a theological discussion and I'll move on from here, but do it in the personal preferences that you do, or place yourself within means of a religious organization or building and do so that way. Because while I understand why, you know, religiously oriented and theological schools and universities exist, because you're studying that discipline, it just makes me wonder why one is preferred over the other in terms of how we got here. Like, wouldn't you want your child to have a broad range to think for themselves?
Well,
and make their own decision.
It's easy to ask these questions coming from two people that didn't have any kind of dogma forced upon us, whereas typically people can't escape it, though,
because we don't share the same belief structure.
Well, I know.
Which is great, because I think that lends itself more to the discussion. But as someone who grew up predominantly Catholic, turned Christian, and who went to church fairly regularly and understands why agnosticism is the way it is, finding not so much fault in faith, but many faults in religion, I often wondered, walking into that classroom, why that was even a discussion we even had to have. Because I'm looking at this and I'm like, we have inherent data for one side of this argument. So if you're on the other side of the argument, you're fucked, other than a book that just says, I said so. So I often just kind of wondered why the balance wasn't there.
It all goes hand in hand with the whole idea of, you know, conservative values that are believed to be, you know, long, withstanding, continuous, never changing. And so to have something challenge that idea, that however long, decades, really centuries long idea, it is going to be like a major affront that challenges the status quo and makes it seem like as though it's either been simplified or the sense of numinousness is gone, even though I would argue you can still have a numinous aspect to it. It's just, it's going to not be so fanciful because it's based more in what's actually there. Tying it back to this, I mean, that's how you get a lot of these figures that arguably didn't believe in this stuff, but then turned around and did, like Ronald Reagan, where they became just these, I hate to use the word, but these champions for these causes that, you know, you're kind of thinking, you're thinking to yourself, why do you care? It doesn't affect you.
Right.
Like, Ronnie, I don't think God made the decision for you to shell out for GE. back in the day, or for that whatever cigarette brand he was promoting, that he was like, well, if you smoke these cigarettes, you're going to have the best lungs in the world. There's no way you're going to die from any illness if you smoke these bad boys. Like, God didn't tell you to do that. Everything he did in his presidency, you know, you ask people now, and obviously hindsight's 20/20. You know, oh, God was there when Reagan made every decision that he made, and you're just like, oh, for goodness sake, like, give me a break. So it's, you know, it's an age-old topic I know we could devote a whole other show to, but continue.
It took a certain spirit of opportunism to graft these social issues, anti-abortion, anti-ERA, anti-gun control, onto the traditional economic agenda of the right. As direct male wizard Richard Viguerie acknowledged, we talk about issues that people care about, like gun control, abortion, taxes, and crime. Yes, they're emotional issues, but that's better than talking about capital formation. Well, I mean, it does get more people in the room talking about these things, but at that point, I'm just assuming people are just tired of talking about money. As the new rights leaders recognized, the social issues were the only hope for winning the working class and middle Americans over to an economic agenda that was unabashedly old right, anti-labor, and pro-business. There remained the problem of defining an enemy. In a less tolerant society, the new right's chosen enemy might have been African Americans, who had been the transparent target of Nixon and Agnew's successful law and order campaign. In a less sophisticated society, the most convenient enemy might have been Jews, who have done service as scapegoats in American right-wing demonology from Father Coughlin in the 30s to Lyndon LaRouche in the 80s.
Oh.
But Nazism had given anti-Semitism a bad name in all but the most extreme, often paramilitary, fringe groups of the right. And blatant public racism had gone so far out of style that even segregationist Wallace had found it expedient as a national figure to drop black people. He had, however, found an alternative in the, quote, pointy-headed professors. It remained only to fashion the political targets of 1968, the John Birch Society, the secret right-wing organization that flourished in the early 60s, fancied itself up against an even more secret group of intellectuals bent on world domination. These Illuminati, quote-unquote, had been scheming to take over the world since the 18th century, and in their modern form, tended to be communists. As described in a 1967 John Birch Society publication, the Illuminati were a, quote, conspiracy conceived, organized, and activated by professionals and intellectuals, many of them brilliant and cunning and clever, who decided to put their minds in the service of total evil. Their main habitat these days seems to be the great subsidized universities, tax-free foundations, mass media communication systems, government bureaus such as the State Department, and a myriad of private organizations such as the Council on Foreign Relations. To the Birchers, the war against communism was almost a lost cause, since even President Eisenhower was, quote, a conscious agent of the communist conspiracy.
That's how batshit this whole, like, everything's a communist, everyone's a communist, everyone's a socialist, this all this red baiting that's been going on since, like, 1920.
Mm-hmm.
This is, like, the zenith of craziness, and believe me, we've only seen it get nuttier since. You know, like, oh, Eisenhower's a communist. Joe Biden's a socialist. Like, what?
My question is this. What happens if someone is identified favoring communist beliefs, like in a court of law? Like, what happens when McCarthyism, to its fullest extent, actually break someone down on the witness stand, and it's like, yeah, okay, you got me. So what happens? Are they jailed? Are they executed? What is the...
Well, in what time context here?
Well,
like, are we talking about the first Red Scare, the second Red Scare, post-60s, now? Like, you got a lot of ground you could cover with that question.
Let's talk about now, let's say. So short of demonizing them on Twitter, in some capacities, I guess. How would this issue get resolved? We don't want any communists in our country. Let's go ahead and ostracize them, I guess, publicly. I don't know. Like, what is the goal for anti-communists when they're in the capacity of a communist?
Well,
is it to convert? Is it to kill? Is it to make them appear as if they're the smarter one in the room? Again, general question, but
right. Well, I'll put it to you this way. I haven't, to my knowledge, I have not heard of anything legal happening these days that involve, you know, Jacques Communista. Like, I just never hear it akin to what happened in the 50s. But, I mean, really, for the most part, I mean, there's not really any legal recourse there because it's a free speech issue. Right. You know, like anyone who says they're a communist or says they're a Nazi can say whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And I'm absolutely not trying to equate the two whatsoever, but you know, there's no legal action by saying, you know, you are a communist or you believe in the tenets of Karl Marx. So then what was the follow up to that? Like, what's the goal of an anti-communist? I mean,
yeah, what's the goal of an anti-communist in the capacity of a communist? You put them in a room together, I guess. What, do you let them duke it out verbally, physically?
I mean, I hate to say it, but most of the time it's them duking it out verbally on a college campus debate stage. And not even a debate stage, just a performance stage. You know, that's all that happens anymore. When, again, I have to go back to, like, the best example, at least, of the post-2010 era, because I think it was before, it had to have been before 2020, because COVID, I don't think it hit yet, but need I say more than, it appears you just believe in this postmodernist Marxist doctrine that I can't find any reason for anyone to be okay with, and it makes me so sad when a transgender person is okay with it. Well, Jordan, you transphobic son of a bitch, I think you're just full of shit, and I win the debate. I mean, I win the debate.
That's the best
example of, like, a conservative and a communist going at it, and there was no legal repercussions or, like, consensus afterward other than, I mean, I don't know, maybe Peterson made some points that actually were vaguely reasonable, but I don't remember. I doubt
it. Like, in that instance, would you say that, like, the man who gets angry first loses?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's always, I'm of the mind that there's always a place for emotion in a debate. I'm not saying it always needs to be there, but if you get to that point where you're slamming your fist at it on a table and you look flustered and drunk and sweaty, then it's a little bit like, okay, maybe tone it down a bit there, Hitch, you know, so it's, yeah.
Okay. Well, when the new right emerged in the mid-70s, the neoconservatives' notion of the new class was ready and waiting to be appropriated. The enemy could be updated. It was not a conspiracy, but something more modern and rational sounding. An entire social class. There remained, however, a touch of the occult, a hint of paranoia in the new right's notion of the new class, which is still sometimes referred to, albeit in lower case, two words, not one, but two, as the Illuminati. As Sidney Blumenthal observed within the New Right, the new class represents a, quote, secret system, a force more insidious than any political party, more influential than any political party. The new class alliance with the poor and minority groups left an obvious strategic alliance for the Republicans with the working class. There we go. And thus, in the new right's view, American society was polarizing between two mighty blocks, the new class and the poor, versus the rich and their allies in the working class in middle America. But to rationalize these alliances, which were still more fanciful than real, The intellectuals of the new right needed to go beyond the fragments of analysis they had inherited from the neoconservatives. They needed to expose what was deeply sinister about the new class and ultimately perverse about its sympathy for the poor. And they needed to do so in ways that a resentful middle America could readily take to heart. In the neoconservative view, what made the new class dangerous was its ambition. Ever on the lookout for new opportunities, the new class had stirred up a fuss about poverty in order to employ and enrich its own members. The poor were only pawns in a power grab, non-combatants in a war ostensibly waged on their behalf. The new right borrowed most of this analysis, but took a colder view of the poor and shared none of the neoconservatives' lingering attachment to the welfare state. Of course not. Why would they? And by the end of the 60s, liberal notions of the culture of poverty had hardened into a conservative horror of the African-American poor, who were conceived as shiftless, violent, and addicted to public handouts. If the new class and the poor were allied, there must be some previously unsuspected affinity between them, some connection that belied the superficial contrast between the excessively ambitious and the excessively lazy. Well, turns out we got it. In his 1975 book, The Making of the New Majority Party, new right strategist William A. Rusher revealed the hidden basis of the emerging class alliances. A wealthy Yale-educated attorney and publisher with an interest in wine tasting, Rusher is one of the new right's most enthusiastic proponents of working-class populism. America, he announced, is no longer divided between the haves and the have-nots, but between the producers and the non-producers. Man, that just struck a chord with me. I can't even explain it.
I'm having that moment that Obi-Wan had in A New Hope when Alderaan blew up, except it's more like I can just hear like at least a dozen different discussions we had throughout
the first season
of Mars on Life just pop back into memory.
I would like to know what constitutes a producer and a non-producer, right?
Well, that's literally the next sentence, my guy.
All right. No. See, I need it dumbed down. I don't need this Aaron Reich, Ian. Okay, the producers are the blue-collar people who make things, plus the capitalists who generously and thoughtfully pay them to do so.
I'm sorry.
I mean, so who make things, not who go to work, not wages and cages, basically, as the modern verbiage would go. The producers of the blue collar. Okay, hence there is an obvious affinity between the very wealthy and the working class. I mean, yeah, I'd say. I haven't met one working class individual in the capacity of the wealthy who wouldn't want to be wealthy. I digress.
You really left that last part of that sentence hanging. That's
together they produce, and together they support everyone else, the swelling population of non-producers.
And this is how you get individuals like my former neighbor acting as though he and Donald Trump, approximate in age, had similar upbringings, even though one was born with a silver spoon in his mouth and was a spoiled, mm-hmm. rotten brat, and the other was raised on a farm in Indiana.
Right.
Same person. Oh my God. Just like, you know, Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent, same person, same upbringing, you know. Oh, they both lost their parents? Yeah, but they grew up in the same situation. Like, just because their moms are both named Martha means bupkis.
Why did you say that name?
I have a very difficult problem regarding that sentence. Together they produce. Yes, I do understand that it takes venture capital and startup funds to get a business off the ground, but
it's the most sea-lazy attempt of solidarity that the new right can have.
Right. So my question is this. Who exactly are the excessively ambitious and the excessively lazy? Now knowing that, does it take on new meaning? Or is there a role reversal? Is Aaron Reich making me think more in the capacity than I would like to? Let's read on. In Rusher's scheme, the poor fit entirely into the category of non-producers, living idly off the dole. The existence of the working poor, who make up over 40% of the poverty population over the age of 14, is seldom acknowledged by the right. Indeed, nothing could be more destructive to, quote, traditional values than the realization that, for millions of Americans, hard work does not pay, but the poor are not the only non-producers. The great central fact that looms over America of the mid-70s is the growth, in the past 25 years, of a whole new economic class, non-producers. They are neither businessmen nor manufacturers, blue-collar workers or farmers. Instead, the dominant members of the new class form a verbalist elite. Before I read on, what does that mean? And I'm asking this sincerely because I sort of have an idea, but I kind of want to know if it's what I'm thinking.
I am not sure, if I'm being completely honest with you.
My interpretation of it is, I'm really trying to boil it down to the simplest. Like, the first thing that my mind went to is someone who spends a lot more time talking about the issues that be rather than, and I don't want to sound too tone deaf when I say this, but rather than working on themselves regarding the issues that be. Like, is that somewhere in the ballpark?
The next paragraph does also sort of answer that, where it says the goal of the new class was to, quote, run the United States, an aim in which they were supported by their, quote, huge and apparently permanent welfare constituency. The affinity between the new class and the poor now made perfect sense. Both groups are parasitic, sly, and at odds with the, quote, basic values held by the producers, haves and have-nots alike.
Mm-hmm.
And I take from those quotes, that's further explaining, those quotes in that paragraph further explain what exactly is intended by when Rusher says form a verbalist elite. Basically, so that new class can actually, like, you know, intersperse its way through society and get what it wants.
Okay.
It doesn't make them producers or you know, non-producers, as it says. Well,
it just makes them commenting on and complaining about the issues or the disparity at play here.
I mean, it's explaining what their place and purpose is in society and why anybody should care to listen to them if they are neither producers or non-producers. It's like, okay, so why should I listen to you if society is divvied up between those that make things and those that are, quote, lazy? Then why should I listen to Richard Viguerie or, you know, William F. Buckley or whoever, Irving Kristol? Like, it's kind of like, okay, who are you then?
Mm-hmm. Labeling the new class non-producers made good populist sense. For as we've seen, this is how working class people tend to see middle class professionals anyway, as people who do not work, at least not in any serious constructive manner. The right had already had some success in tapping resentment against, quote, lazy welfare recipients, and perhaps hoped to turn the same kind of resentment against the new class. Mr. Rusher is right, a commentator wrote in the Conservative Digest. The honoring and rewarding of work must become the basic economic principle of the new political party. He regretted, however, that there still was too much blue-collar apathy about the new class's threat to big business. Oh, God forbid.
Mm-hmm.
From a capitalist point of view, the new class does, on the whole, earn its keep quite nicely. Even the most woolly-headed verbalists are capable of filling a variety of essential capitalist functions, writing advertising copy for new products, teaching others how to comport themselves in a complex and hierarchical society, or, like Rusher and other intellectuals of the new right, writing pseudo-populist defenses of big business. Whether out of self-interest or a clearer understanding of the new class's role, the neoconservatives had never gone so far as to suggest that their own class was parasitical and hence expendable. But this was the inescapable drift of Rusher's analysis. The producers of America, he wrote, the businessmen, workers, and farmers have a common economic interest in limiting the growth of this rapacious new non-producing class. Oh, I thought it was just about money. Silly me. Here an ominous tone creeps in. Why just limit the growth of this useless and scheming class? Without specifying exactly what should be done to them, Rusher listed three targets for the right. First would be the welfare recipients. Second, the leftist students and their professors. Not that leftists of any kind were a significant force by 1975.
True.
And then, he warned, it will be the turn of the other non-producers who have recently learned to live as a matter of right off the generosity of working Americans. The 21st century equivalent would be the entrepreneurial TikToks that you no doubt see on your timeline. And every time I see those, I just want to because it just makes me so, so angry that people could be that tone deaf in regards to, well, I made it. Why can't you?
I don't think, though, that's what she's referring to. Or, well, at least the 1970s equivalent of that, whatever that might be. I think it's more like the kind of thing that led to the, whatever it was called in the 90s, not the Gingrich, I think it was called the Gingrich Revolution, where it was, in essence, and, you know, Bill Clinton gave them what they wanted, because it's what he wanted, too, the end of the welfare state, and just slashing programs left and right, all these things that, you know, were put into place thanks to Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty and safeguards put into place by the Civil Rights Act. And the new right was like, okay, all these black people that are, in their view, getting quote-unquote special treatment, we're going to get rid of that. All these poor people that are getting help, all these single moms that are getting help to raise their kids and babysitting and social services, all this great stuff. No, we don't want Marxist super nanny, to borrow a Mark Fisher term. So, and, oh, regulations, who wants that? Who wants to be healthy in a modern society? No. We got to get rid of these things. It's too much government interference. It's people getting too much free stuff. That's socialism. Come on, man.
Come on, man.
I mean, you wish it was different, you know?
Oh, of course, yeah.
And just because America, just because the founding fathers went with this model instead of the iron-backed business model of the subscription service. Like, can you imagine if all government programs were like subscription services? You pay by the month, you get an innately large repertoire of what you can experience, and you can just say, well, I'm just going to cancel my medical for this month. I don't need it.
I don't know.
I don't anticipate on getting hurt this month.
In a twisted way, and maybe I'm thinking about it a little differently, it almost feels like it is like that, where it's like, okay, you want a more, you know, authoritarian government. Okay, fine. Guess what? Your tax returns are going to be terrible. But I thought we were, like, you know, sending money to all these foreign countries that are, like, far, far away. And I thought we were going to do all these things that don't help us. Why? Oh, the government's going to build a fence around the Capitol building. Oh, okay. That's something you don't see in democracies or even republics, really. The government's going to take away this and that. Oh, I can't get my free COVID test. Okay, well, can I at least get some extra money so I can go pay for a COVID test? Oh, my tax return's going to be smaller. Oh, well, gee, then. Oh, and the government's also going to, like, have more security at the southern border. Oh, gee, well, wow, this really is money for nothing. Or everything for no money, more like it. So, anyway, I could keep going and before you know it, I'll be shaving my head, too. All right. Permissiveness. The crime of the new class. As the 70s wore on, the new right's case against the new class expanded, adding ever more lurid and nasty charges. The right had originally designed its enemy to capture the resentments of blue-collar and lower-middle-class Americans offended by the African-American insurgency and the student movement. Hence, a new class that was power-hungry, troublemaking, and parasitical. But as the right began to forge a constituency among Christian fundamentalists, its image of the new class changed accordingly. The new class remained as power-hungry as ever, but at the same time it became irreligious, secular humanist, dissolute, and bent on infecting the entire society with its lax morals and hedonistic outlook. In the words of new right intellectual George Gilder, it had created an establishment culture wallowing in a secular hedonist swamp. An establishment culture wallowing in a secular hedonist swamp. Doesn't that just go to show that American politics has not been able to come up with anything new or original in the last, you know, oh, what is this? Probably like, let's say like roughly 1980. No one in politics has had an original idea for a little bit over 40 years.
I wonder why. I wonder why career politicians who don't have a new idea to save their life.
Well, it goes beyond, here's the thing though, it goes beyond just politicians, because it just goes to show that, and I think this is where it gets to the real root of why we're in, I hate that I keep resorting to the Jimmy Carter line, of a malaise, politically, is a lot of our quote-unquote thinkers today are not coming up with anything all that new. You know, all the people that get propped up, both on the left and the right, they're not coming up with anything. Well, okay, liberal thinkers and conservative to Nazi adjacent thinkers, none of them have anything that's actually new or relevant. If anything, it's all just dumbing down conversations that were already being had 40 years ago. And, you know, at the end of the day, the only people that make any kind of difference out of having this never-ending discussion that ultimately will never result in anything getting done or anything being agreed upon from some standpoint of consensus, the only people that win in this are the quote-unquote thinkers. Oh, you know, my umpteenth book about why this figure from history was killed, even if they really weren't, Bill O'Reilly. Oh, I'm a millionaire now, and I'm a New York Times best-selling author, and I had a TV show. Ta-Nehisi Coates, I don't want to have to go both barrels, but I could. Like, okay, you've pretty much, for the most part, like, ditched everything that made you a public intellectual on ideas that, you know, for the most part, had promise, but also were devoid of anything political. And when you did invoke politics, it was so milquetoast and it was so, like, hackneyed that it's like, yeah, no shit you're going to go back to, what's it called? Okay. No shit you're going to go back to, what's it called, writing comic books. So I look at the whole brain industry and the whole marketplace of ideas as just something we shouldn't be paying attention to, so... The New Right's leaders, both secular and religious, saw America in the midst of moral breakdown. It had abandoned the biblical commandments and was awash with sin. As moral majority leader Reverend Jerry Falwell later reflected, if ever there was a time when God needed a job done, it was during the 1960s and 70s. The future of our nation was at stake. I sincerely believe that Satan had mobilized his own forces to destroy America by negating the Judeo-Christian ethic. Oh boy, there's... Now you know where Ben Shapiro gets it from. Secularizing our society and devaluating human life through the legalization of abortion and infanticide. God needed voices raised to save the nation from inward moral decay. Oh god, and Pat Buchanan gets mentioned next. Oh, this is like the Haunted Mansion. More secular New Rightists emphasized the betrayal not of God, but of, quote, traditional values. Hard work, self-denial, and family loyalty were giving way to the mass pursuit of individual gratification. Hedonism is the spirit of the age, warned New Right columnist Patrick J. Buchanan in 1978, who, if I recall, at one point was deliberating running for president with a certain real estate mogul by the name of Donald J. Trump. And Trump toyed with it, and then I think turned it down because he was like, oh, he's clearly an anti-Semite. He's infatuated with Adolf Hitler. And you can find the footage of that. It's really hilarious. And like Roger Stone's in the background, and you're, and again, it just goes to show, like, nothing ever changes. Like, it's the same people over and over. Oh, Joe Biden. Oh, you mean the same guy that, like, let Reagan pass everything and, you know, the same guy that just sat there and let Clarence Thomas be on the Supreme Court? Oh, that guy. He's president now. That guy who did that, who did the thing, not to sound like him, the guy who did the thing 30 years ago is president now. Oh, gee. What a world. There was abortion, homosexuality, promiscuity, pornography, drug abuse, godlessness, and feminism.
All on your local arts campus.
The latter conceived by the new right as a huge upsurge of female selfishness. Underlying this mass breakdown in morality was a single cause, a deep and central cultural failing. This was permissiveness, a notion the new right borrowed from the critics of the student movement and now applied to liberalism itself, and of course to the new class, which was liberalism personified. Permissiveness may be the most indispensable word in the new right vocabulary. Whatever the problem, from promiscuity to excessive government spending, permissiveness is the cause. In post-conservative America, Kevin Phillips, who is critical of the new right but remains one of its intellectual resources, uses permissiveness in dozens of contexts. There is judicial permissiveness. Permissiveness, homosexuality and abortion. Permissiveness in education. Permissiveness, permissiveness in mainstream, i.e. not evangelical churches. So, to go back to your point earlier, oh, well, why can't you have, you know, why can't the fundamentalists just kind of like, you know, give and take? Well, that's permissiveness. You can't give in.
Yeah.
What was the movie where the guy says you can't?
I was going to say.
Oh, Harvey Dent, he does. You can't give in.
I believe synonymously, isn't permissiveness being tolerant? You know, I often wonder what the disconnect is. Maybe it's me. Maybe I'm wrong. Like, I hate to bring out the whole so much for the tolerant, you know, insert your meme there, but
right.
I hate to say gotcha moment, but fucking gotcha, you know, like I wonder what's so wrong about giving and taking, right? Because I would venture to say, and this is just me hypothesizing, but I would venture to say that experiencing or not experiencing a religion of your choice and allowing yourself to either believe or not believe in the faith would get you closer to understanding why it's important to believe or not believe.
But then they throw it back that you can't have doubt, because if you have doubt, then guess what? That faith loses a follower.
Well, fuck you then. How about that?
Well, and the faiths used to do that back in the day, because if you had doubt, guess what? It was a literal fuck you, and your head's on the ground. So
how about excommunication, and I could just buy my way back into heaven?
What?
Yeah, once you were excommunicated, yeah, couldn't you just buy your way back into heaven? Wasn't it called paying? Like the Catholic Church did it.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well.
I don't know. Hail Marys. I don't know. Maybe I'm. Anyway.
Hail Marys. Different times.
So permissiveness in the, you know, churches, plus a generalized permissivism of various economic, diplomatic, sociological, and sexual hues. He even warns about a link between permissiveness and imperial decline. Oh, that's
imperial decline.
That's real. Well, hey, that, you know, a lot of people argue that. Well, a lot of people argue. I sound like Trump. A lot of people argue. But there are a lot of thinkers that I am more inclined to listen to. That basically focus on, you know, typically historians that are more revisionist historians that are try to contextualize this moment compared with America post-World War II and basically since post-World War II. In the 90s, it was the whole end of history thing, but now it's more tangible. It's more like the end of the American Empire. We had our little adventures in the Middle East, and then after that, it was like, okay, so what does the Empire do? You know, we already have dominion over God's earth, so to carry on the verbiage of our church discussions, what else is left? You know, and don't give me the Tim Curry space line, you know, where he's like a Soviet guy and he's like, oh comrade, we go to space. Are you familiar with that? Or you look like I just let off a big stinky one.
You may as well have just told me, you may as well have just been speaking to me in Klingon. I know who Tim Curry is. I'm unfamiliar.
Space!
But no, I mean, it's basically the idea that, like, yeah, for a big glorious empire like the United States, we've become a joke empire at this point. Anyway, he even warns about a link between permissiveness and imperial decline, buttressing the point with a quote from pop historians Will and Ariel Durant. By the time of Caesar, you had a permissive society and a pagan society in the sense of sexual enjoyment with a minimal moral restraint. So frequently does the notion of permissiveness appear in right-wing literature that it is hard to believe that it can retain any concrete meaning or explanatory power. As a generalized explanation, permissiveness came to occupy the place that affluence once held in liberal critiques of America almost 20 years earlier. Affluence, as we saw in Chapter 1, was not just a material condition, wealth, but came to be seen as a vague and suffocating atmosphere, hovering everywhere. So too with permissiveness, which could be considered the evil distillate of affluence. In the ideology of the New Right, it is everywhere, explaining everything from individual personality and behavior to the broad cultural outlines of American society. It can be found at every level of social organization, from the individual to family to the nation. As one writer observed plaintively in the Conservative Digest, George Washington was not a permissive individual. He did not come from a permissive family. So the U.S. did not begin as a permissive society. Is it too late to go back to our beginnings?
Oh, God. Oh, the people yearning for the good old days.
I should have read that sounding like Mark Levin.
Oh, Jesus, man. Like,
the word.
I wonder, too. Mm. If people have these sentiments because they genuinely believe that if they lived in that time frame, they would be somebody. But instead, they're nobody in the time that they're currently living in. Okay. Right. So they yearn for a potentially better, maybe an easier time when, say, the black coworker wasn't your equal, or the woman wasn't your equal, or that we didn't have to see rainbows in the sky and attribute it to something else besides a rainbow in the sky. I wonder if these intolerantly espoused and just good old boy sentiments have just any connection to the fact that these individuals can't stand living in the now. But they're at an age where they don't even remember how it was then. They weren't even born. They're just hoping off of the propagandist culture that has, you know, the propagandist historian culture that, oh yeah, it'd just be so much better if it was back in the 50s.
I'm having like major deja vu because I remember us having this conversation, but I think I was saying everything you're saying and you were like, yeah, but the economics of the 50s were pretty good. And I was like, true, but
the economics of the 50s, I do attest, were pretty good as any post-war country would be. Yeah. But at the same time, too, it's just like, now I'm tackling it from the perspective of, haha, you're insecure that you were born in the wrong generation.
The argument has been around since at least the end of the Civil War, as crazy as it sounds. Like, since Reconstruction, there's been that argument, typically from more bigoted Americans that are basically thinking, if only my government was, you know, paying me to be as wealthy as I could have been, rather than paying, you know, people of color. Which, you know, laughably, Reconstruction did not provide reparations, but it certainly gave so many steps forward so that black people could be elevated in society, while not necessarily doing a whole lot for white people that were left bereft in the South after the war, because their economy was totally wrecked.
But it also makes me wonder, what would you do with those opportunities, you nobody? You know? Not really. Like, you think that scaling back the clock 70 years would put you at a better place in society, what, just because You pass as a white straight male? Like, good for you. That's not ultimately something that we have a choice over at the beginning of our lives. So what would it matter anyway?
Just from existing online and seeing people, like, it was trending not that long ago where there was this young woman who was, she was dressed up in a certain way to act almost as if she was somebody from either the 50s or the 40s.
Oh, was this the article about the housewife?
I don't know if she's a housewife, but...
Like the trad wife kind of thing where a woman acts explicitly subservient to her husband in alliance with traditional household views. And you have one side of the aisle being like, well, that's her choice and Godspeed and rah, rah, rah. And the other side being like, this is literal just... modern day slavery, you know, you threw feminism out the window.
This wasn't that. This was literally just like best way I can describe it, a TikTok influencer who was like,
oh, all right.
I dress like this because I like to wear, not only do I like to wear these clothes, but I think if I could go back in time and live in that period, I know I'd have such a swell time. And the backlash she got, and I know there's probably more information that I'm leaving out, but that's...
Jarvis, pull up that race, please. Was she white?
She was white, yeah. Okay. And she alluded to this idea of, you know, just how she feels like she would be happier in that time, and how she... If anything, it was almost like an aesthetic choice. Like, oh, I'd love to live in that time because I feel like, you know, I'd like this and that, and the attire and the clothes and whatever.
Oh, so it's...
But
TikTok,
the problem is... And this has kind of opened up a wider discussion about the whole concept of, oh, I wish I was alive in this time period or that time period, where up until a certain point, and, you know, arguably there's no right answer here, I think, because if you're a woman, if you're a person of color, if you're Jewish, if you're gay, if you're Muslim, whatever it might be, certainly it's a lot better now comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
It still doesn't mean we live in a perfect time where, you know, I mean, George Floyd, anybody, like, that was modern-day lynching. And it's going to reach a point down the line in the future where it's not going to be considered modern-day anymore. It's just going to be considered lynching equivalent to what happened in 1920. Mm. You know, like, we're going to be sitting here in 2050 if we're not up to our throats in seawater, basically analogizing what happened in 2020 to 1920 as if it's just, you know, oh, it's just a memory. And it's like, well, probably not, because in 1950, there's probably going to be robots doing the exact same thing that Derek Chauvin did. And the point I'm getting at is, you know, there really is not a great time to be any minority or have, you know, somebody of an unpopular political belief, whatever it might be. There's no perfect time for it, but if you want to go back to a time where it was really bad, you know, say for Jewish people all around the world, like the 1930s or 40s, it's kind of like, okay, so you want to live in a time where Adolf Hitler is, you know, basically bringing the concentration camps to life. That's a pretty horrible time period to want to live in. Then again, the people that lived in that period, it's not like they had a choice.
Right.
So right. It's a very sticky situation that I'm on, well, you could argue there's two sides. I would argue I'm on one side and a third side, where what time is perfect? What time is best? What time is better? I mean, here's the thing. When people say to me, oh, Ryan, you were born in the wrong decade, or I say things like, you know, oh, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, yeah, the 1970s, that would have been cool to live through. Better music, better entertainment. You know what? People will say, oh, yeah, better music, better entertainment from the 1970s. Just point blank. They're not implying that, like, oh, I want to live in a time where, you know...
I don't want to live in a time where Colts walked the earth and you could be... Like, Mr. Manson, hi.
Right. I mean, there's so many caveats with it, and sometimes it really is just a matter of, like, I think if anything, it's just with this particular woman, it came across as she looked very much like white suburban housewife. Like she looked like June Cleaver. So, which begs the question of like, okay, as a woman in that time period, how are you being treated by your husband? Or by your colleagues? I'm not going to make any rush to judgment, but
if you want to live in that decade anyway, where these prominent issues were on the rise and even, you know, compared to today, still haven't been fixed, what does that say on your take towards how you view minorities in the 21st century?
Exactly.
You know, or, well, I don't
and
know.
There's an additional like, argument to it where all of the rah-rah patriots that say 1776 will commence again. Okay, let me get my DeLorean. I'll put you in the driver's seat. Go 88 miles per hour, and I want to see you at the battle of at the battles of Lexington and Concord. I want somebody to give you, which is not that far away from me. As we, believe me, that's one of those like surreal things where I was. I think I already said this on Mars on Life, driving through Lexington, I was driving through Concord and seeing a sign saying Lexington's that way, and I'm just like, wait.
Wow, people died here.
that Lexington and Concord? And yes. I mentioned it to my sister, and she's like, yeah, that you live Lexington. In Massachusetts. And I'm like, hey, we don't have that kind of stuff in California where, like, American mythology is literally down the street. Like, sorry.
We just have a bunch of land taken away from the indigenous. Yeah. But, you go far enough, you end up finding a big wall, you know? So,
and it does extend into the ocean. But, you know, put a musket in that quote unquote patriot, modern day patriot's hands and dare them. Okay. Mr. 1776, even though like
Mr. Concord was 1775. No. There's a Oath Keepers.
Oh, geez.
Three percenters. There's various nicknames, and I know
the Minutemen. Yeah.
They go by various creeds.
I'll give you a rifle, and then oh look, there's the Redcoats. Go get them, cowboy. Are they?
But there's a lot of them.
Yeah. Oh, it's going to be, it's literally going to be like,
With my modern day weapons, you know, I destroy them. And it's like, okay, well, that's the point. You don't understand what is at stake, what was at stake, and you have no historical grasp of context and what it means to live in the world that you are now with all the quote unquote luxuries and freedoms that you have. And it's like, the fact of the matter is that, and this will be my last point.
Mm-hmm.
America prides itself on being so first world that I would venture to guess you go to any offshore states that no one ever thinks to go, or even hell, for those patriots daring enough to even get on a plane and go across the ocean, yeah. I'd venture to guess that there are maybe some countries that are still third world. I'm being sarcastic here.
Okay.
Look outside the scope of the state that you live in, Mr. Yeah. You know.
Well, and to think of it also this way, like, oh, you go back in time to the Revolutionary War era, and you think of yourself as elite now, or I mean, I don't know, maybe you don't, maybe, okay, maybe not elite. You think of yourself as being that uber patriot that can overlap with the likes of Donald Trump, but also be down in the dirt with the likes of, I don't know, who's a good troglodytic example? Oh my God.
Who are we asking about?
Well, I'm thinking of sort of like a lowbrow, not so polished conservative figure of today.
Oh.
That thinks of themselves as like real working class.
I mean, you
Earth,
said
America.
I mean, you said Mark Levin, but I mean, I guess if you want to,
he's
Hey,
he's intellectual.
Man,
he's got soft hands.
He has a fucking radio show. Okay, whoop-de-doo. And we have more internet access than someone of his demographic would ever think to reach. Okay,
well, okay,
so who really wins?
Here's
a
good example. I just thought of one. I really plucked it out of the Rolodex. You know, if you have somebody that thinks they can overlap with Trump or the like, you know, the likes of all their favorite Fox News friends, and then overlap that with the likes of the Bundy family, for example.
Okay.
And then they go back in time and they think, oh, well, these people will be just like me. And are they even going to accept you? Are they going to tolerate you? Like, probably not.
But the question then remains, what if they're not?
What if they're not what?
What if they're not just like you? What if they take
exactly
at face value, legitimately analyze them, internalize them, and then just say, it's not for me? Well, I wouldn't consider that a strike on them as an individual. I would just say, wow, someone who actually has a thought process and decided this lifestyle, this culture, this political side isn't for me. I see what you're saying. But
giving him too much credit.
Oh, well, let's finish this chapter, because my God.
Okay. The word permissive had not always been a catch-call code for moral breakdown. Prior to 1966, the word permissiveness found little employment outside of discussions of child-raising practices. In 1968, as we have seen, it gained wide exposure as a verbal weapon in the intellectuals' backlash against student radicals. At the same time, the word had begun to take on specifically sexual connotations. For example, in 1969, the mass media were referring to the permissiveness that currently pervades literature, films, and the theater, by which they did not mean indulgent approaches to child raising, but nudity, sexual openness, and sexual diversity. Permissiveness, in the new sexualized sense, included all the wanton things they did. From there, the pubescent sexualized notion of permissiveness could quickly matured into its all-inclusive new right usage. And credit for this last transformation probably goes to Spiro Agnew and his speechwriter Patrick Buchanan. In 1969, Agnew quoted Walter Lacker. There we go. Yeah, I had to, like, recall that from the memory palace. Quoted Walter Lacker writing in commentary on, quote, the cultural and political idiocies perpetrated with impunity in this permissive age. Soon after, Agnew was indicting not just parents, not just sexual freedom, but the total permissive atmosphere that is sweeping the country. Hence, by the 70s, layers of different meanings had built an extraordinarily evocative power into the notion of permissiveness. Anything could be permissive. A person, a class, a society, a policy, a form of behavior. To say that a policy was permissive was first of all to say that it was indulgent and superficially kind, but only superficially kind. Had not permissive upbringing spoiled an entire generation of young people? Had not permissive social policies unleashed a swarm of ills, from crime to obscenity to sexual abandon? Ooh. Permissiveness was the most deceitful form of leadership possible. Cruelty masked as compassion. It was a poisoned form of love. Seductive, ubiquitous, and ultimately lethal. Beyond that, permissiveness revealed the individual wantonness of its practitioners. To indulge others, in however a cruel and misguided way, was to betray a fatal failure of self-control. The impulse to give improper liberties to the young or the poor actually grew out of one's own licentiousness and lack of discipline. Somehow the new right deduced that educated, middle-class liberals, the professors, foundation staff, media people, and others who make up the right's concept of the new class are personally given to libertinism, and that societal permissiveness springs from the personal decadence of new class members. In Thunder on the Right, what a weird, weird title, Alan Crawford describes the suspicion, common on the new right, that, quote, the lifestyles of Easterners, meaning for the most part new class Easterners, are somewhat racier than the rightist's own, and that this decadence explains liberal political attitudes. To many thinkers on the right, new class decadence was decisively revealed by the youthful counterculture of the 60s. Never mind that so many elders of the professional middle class, including quite liberal ones, had been repelled by the hippies, or that, at that time, of the right's discovery of new class decadence, the counterculture had been dead for some years. On the right, images of pot-smoking protesters, nude revelers, and Woodstockian orgies remained vivid long after the counterculture itself had faded into nostalgia. Sounds a lot like a discussion we had earlier. Having real deja vu of a very apocalyptic landscape that I believe you referred to as, I'm sorry, I have to go back to this. Saw this photo for the first time and was like, damn, homeboy pissed in a wine bag.
I've yet to hear a rebuttal.
Oh, God. Writing in 1975, Kevin Phillips turned the entire new class into a horde of hippies, though his imagery is even more outdated, suggesting early 60s beats as well as hippies. Conceiving themselves unfettered by the past, the new elite thought that society would be unfettered, and old restraints cast aside. Aided by the revolution in oral contraceptives, moral standards were thrown off, from King's Road in London's Chelsea to San Francisco's North Beach. What had become promiscuity became openness, naturalness, and freedom. Drugs were tolerated and even encouraged. As if having second thoughts about locating the entire liberal elite from, say, Eugene McCarthy to Chief Justice Earl Warren in some North Beach pad, Phillips added the qualification that, quote, none of these attitudes have ever been universally shared by the emerging knowledge elite, emphasis added. Perhaps the right's strongest secular indictment of new class decadence is a 1982 essay by new right theorist Samuel T. Francis, then a legislative assistant to Senator John East. Francis, himself the holder of a typically new class PhD in history, began by explaining that the new right's insights do not derive from any tainted new class sources. They are not, quote, premeditated in academic seminars, calculated with precision in the inner sanctums of tax-exempt foundations, or debated in the stately prose of quarterly and fortnightly journals. Rather, they spring fully formed from a populist sense of injustice, and thus do not require supporting evidence. Having established his license to say just about anything, Francis proceeds to contrast the liberal elite's cosmopolitan ethic with the domestic ethic, supposedly upheld by the white working class. Conveniently, from an employer's point of view, the workers still uphold the duty of work, the social and human necessity of sacrifice and deferral of gratification. The new class's cosmopolitan ethic, on the other hand, idealizes material indulgence, the glorification of the self, and the transcendence of conventional values, loyalties, and social bonds. What kind of person exemplifies this self-serving ethic? And hence the spirit of the new class. As Francis suggests, its most perfect, though extreme, expression is perhaps Mick Jagger, but a more typical and vapid form is portrayed in advertisements that tell us what kind of man reads Playboy. There is something schizophrenic about the character of the new class as seen by the new right. How could any group of people be so recklessly self-indulgent and yet so successful at imposing their will on everyone else? Or, to use Francis's images, how much precision could one expect from inner sanctums that were no doubt clouded with marijuana smoke? By the way, 420. Would not the stately prose of the fortnightly journals be overcome with the beat of rock and roll and the minds of technocrats dulled with sexual surfeit? Unfazed by this paradox, Francis asserts that new class decadence and ambition are not only connected, but logically inseparable. These lifestyles, values, and ideals represent the logical outgrowth of the new class's own structural interests. Large social engineering government in alliance with corporations, universities, and foundations, the mass media, unions, and other bureaucracies. Somehow, in ways that resist explanation, The entire bureaucratic edifice of new class power, government, universities, foundations, rests on a secret libertinism, which these institutions in turn propagate into the rest of society as permissiveness. And with that, you understand now how the whole concept of a establishment came into power, came into being. I would almost argue that whole chapter, well, not the chapter, but that whole, both sections that we read were Rick Perlstein condensed down into a couple dozen pages.
Right. Well, 212 pages in, I still don't have a solution.
Well, let me ask you this then, because I am noticing a theme here outside of what the book's theme is about the proletarianization of the middle class, but this idea that there needs to be a answer or a solution or something that will give us insight into what needs to be done to fix all of our ills that we've created for ourselves in society.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you were looking for, and how would you react if there isn't an answer or solution provided by the end of the text?
Yes, that is something that I'm looking for. And I guess if it's not in the text, I'd have to say that, ironically, I'm not surprised. Though I think that we touched on a couple of good points in regards to identifying who it is that is currently in power and sort of the socioeconomic habits that we have that has streamlined its downfall as of now.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm really wondering is that what would really be the inherent harm of looking at it any differently? Because I know that Ehrenreich is just, like you or I, an observer of her time and thought to put pen to paper in regards of, well, what it means.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here you and I both are on, I think, an equally important medium trying to ask that same question. Not so much trying to finish what she started, because I don't think it's a question that necessarily has an answer verbally. I think it more so just has an answer in practice. So what political practices need to happen? What economic practices need to happen? Ideally, it would be the shift from overt materialism and sequestering that to one political belief or the other in order to justify in doing so. I could do away with that, for one.
Mm-hmm.
It would also be the doing away with the regurgitation of outdated political policies, both national and international, that perpetuate these behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
My third kind of endeavor in this sort of plan of attack is more so on the expectations of the proletariat just being decent individuals, because while I'm not trying to insinuate any kind of class warfare, I believe that the book has illustrated it time and again, the haves and the have-nots, and it makes me wonder why there isn't more unification, whether it be of political parties or of economic classes, in regards to the haves and have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I ask these questions and I realize that.
Well, that last one, I know I've given an answer before about why you don't have that kind of cohesion, but
is it wrong of me to say that I just can't accept that answer? Because I don't, and maybe it's just the fact, like, I understand what's at play here, and I understand that.
Well, hold on, what was my answer to that?
That there needs to be inherent, That there can't be equalization, that there needs to be conflict.
No, I think what you just said about, you know, why, you know, for example, if you have this proletariat and if it incorporates all these different kinds of people from working class, blue collar, professional, managerial class. Why can't all these forces come together? And obviously this extends to political ideology as well. Like, why can't the liberals get together with the socialists and the communists and the, you know, moderates that just want better living conditions for themselves and their family? That all in of itself is great to have, but the lack of unity all stems from the reinforcement of this idea that America is built upon the backs of the individual. And you keep hammering home that ideology of, you know, individual freedom and stuff like that. And you basically, I mean, believe me, this was for a good chunk of the last century, a very concerted effort to make sure that anything even hinting at mutual aid, solidarity, like all these little words and terms that are known throughout, you know, any kind of leftist cause, get rid of it all, because even if it's hinting at just basic human decency, oh no, we can't have that. So that's the answer to, at least to that point. Obviously, in terms of politics, I think what you were alluding to, that's the definition of politics is what you were, or at least my and many other people's definition, that was what you were alluding to. But sorry, continue.
I don't know. I find myself, I guess, just wishing things were better, or I guess just wishing there was another way. And I don't know, I guess just by having these discussions, it feels pretty self-sabotaging, knowing that there's really no solution. And at the end of the day, we're going to be finishing this book and walking away from it as individuals, only trying to do what we can.
Right.
For the greater good. I think if there was one thing that I would wish for is that, similar to my time spent drawing political cartoons, there's an ego, there's an unspoken ego boost that occurs when the wrong people don't get it and the right people do. And I'd love to know if this book in any capacity is sort of a deterrent to those who simply don't want to learn. Now, of course, that doesn't answer the question of what do you do with people who are just outright intolerant. You know, do you attempt to re-educate, or do you, I don't know, hunt them down? Like, I don't know. What would be the solution to just outright intolerant individuals who won't accept further education, perhaps won't see people any other way, and who think that this is the greatest country on earth, when in all actuality we have many reasons to believe that it's not?
Well, to those folks, it's about showing them what an alternative could be, and showing them the actual benefit of what that new world could look like. Now we're getting into capitalist realism territory, which a book I'm.
Therein lies the contradiction of what you just said, of it being, if it's an overtly individualist mindset that it was built upon, they're of course going to look at it as what's the benefit that I get out of it? And if there's no inherent benefit, in someone overtly, say, bigoted, to know that someone somewhere, minority, what have you, is going to benefit and they're not, I mean, that's going to be demonizing to their line of thought. That's automatically going to trigger the kill switch, you know, like, no, absolutely not. And it just makes me wonder that if they were to read between the lines and understand why collectively it's a good thing, what the potential could hold.
Unfortunately, that is where you do have to start addressing them.
Like, what do you address them as? Do you address them as less than, as those who just aren't willing to learn?
No, I mean, what I was going to say was you do have to start out by. It's tricky because I've seen examples done right where if you talk in more broad terms, obviously there's, you know, not to harken back to Letters to a Young Contrarian, but like there's times where you got to be very mindful of politicians that talk about the collective we and you know, verbiage like that, but that kind of populism.
Then here's a question.
That populism does have its advantages, and it does get to a point where if you can keep using that to get people to start moving away from that individual ideology and think more like, okay, well, it's helping my neighbors, it's helping my family, and, you know, not my direct family in my house, but like, it's, I'm seeing a benefit. Maybe this is a good idea for everyone. You know,
how do we change cognitive and public thought that when we attribute anything to it being we or collective, that they're not going to automatically go for the demonization route of, oh, communism. So how do we change that dialogue and make it less triggering, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Part of it is how you sell it. I mean, I think that's always going to be the big kicker. I mean, why do you think Trump was so successful? So
I just can't fathom that selling it. Like, to me, selling it just seems very, there's a sleazy connotation that maybe I'm the only one picking up on it. It's like, I don't want to sell anyone on something. I want to legitimately educate. I don't want to pull the rug out.
Right.
As politicians do more often than not. And it's, you know, in order to achieve their own self-interests of being a politician. And it's like, I don't want to sell someone. I would even go so far as to say, I don't even want to convince. I would want people to come to that conclusion of just having it be the innately right decision. And perhaps I'm asking too much, but I think in a modern era where the educational opportunities are at one's fingertips, I don't really see an excuse for individuals who can't make that choice for the better.
But then it begs the question of, you know, if you are running for office and you are trying to get everyone to be on your side and to agree with you, and you do have something that you do want them to get behind as part of your platform, you can't always just rely on them to think it's inherently right or it's inherently true. Or,
but why would I need
their own homework? Like,
why would I need to dumb down that for them when they should be of sound body and mind to make that decision to even show up to a voting ballot?
Because not everyone is. That's the big catch. That's why, you know, working in politics is so damn hard. And again,
I would,
like, the whole,
you know, honestly, I would say for the majority of it being uneducated voters, I'd say it'd be pretty damn easy. Only problem is that I don't want to go the easy route in seeking a career in politics. I would want to go for the legitimately educational. These are my beliefs. Do they appeal? Yes or no. And if they don't, I would even make a case to say, okay, well, that's fine. Maybe another one of my hopes is that politics could be a bit more cordial and discussions shouldn't be televised to the umpteenth degree that they are in regards of them being equated to a modern day reality show. Are we so used to politics being televised to such a degree that there has to be that layer of drama for people to remotely pay attention?
That is part of it. Absolutely.
Okay. So, mm-hmm. Then that would kind of beg the question of where these people stand intellectually. If all they can view it through is that lens and not the issue, the lens of it being dramatized and not the issues themselves, I don't know. Should people like that vote? Controversial question, maybe, but if people are going to spend their days at the ballot box voting for personalities rather than issues, I don't have sympathy remotely for those individuals who vote with their hearts and not with their brains.
Well, think of it this way. You have the people that do go out of their way to vote because they really believe these issues will affect them and positively impact them. And then down the line, all of a sudden, I've said this before, like, all of the people that pre-Trump for decades voted Republican simply because, oh, you know what? It's I do it for economic purposes. I do it because I want to have better taxes, and that's it. Well, after all these years, after years of saying I'm going to vote for, you know, my Republican representative, my Republican senator, my Republican presidential candidate, and each time they won, and it led to another conservative on the Supreme Court, do your taxes feel so much better now that female family members don't have access to their own reproductive health?
Right. And,
you know, really, it's one of those issues where obviously taxes and money and.
Right. But to those individuals that don't have the forethought of looking ahead and looking side to side to see who it would impact as well.
Yeah.
That's also someone who I don't have sympathy for. I'm sorry, but the world isn't revolved around your political beliefs.
Right.
Like, it's easy to believe that because your political party wins, you feel as though you're the only person on earth and that you could do no wrong.
But
you can't, and it's not.
But at the same time, you got to think about the people that are like, oh, I may be a registered Republican, but that doesn't mean I vote Republican all the time. I mean, I...
Well, good for them. But at that point, everyone just may as well be independent if they're just going to be like, if there's going to be this stigma about crossing the aisle or jumping it or whatever verbiage you want to say, at that point, you just got to go with what makes sense to you. But that not excluding those around you, those who you care about, those that would predominantly be affected by these issues if X, Y, and Z were to be put into place. So, again, it takes a little bit of analyzing the context, subtext of a policy and the potential consequences of it. And... I mean, it's like, oh, hindsight's 2020. How about you get some hindsight now?
Well, and on top of it as well, it begs the question of, because I hear what you're saying, and I know I've had countless, oh, I got to get going in a little bit, but I've heard countless arguments about, same as what you're saying, where it's like, you know, if you have an uninformed populace voting, should they be voting? Then you get into murky waters where you start asking yourself, okay, are we really a democracy? Because then it begs the question of, okay, if in a democracy, everyone should have the right to vote. Everyone should have an equal opportunity to go out and vote however way they please. You look at early America and it didn't pan out like that until really the 1820s. And it was at that point that you had people that thought, you know what, I'm voting for somebody that gets my issues. I'm voting for somebody that, you know, wants me to thrive, somebody that's from my neck of the woods, and therefore that's why they're getting my vote. That's why Andrew Jackson's getting my vote. Well, even though we didn't think about those kinds of things at the time when it came to race and other people that happen to live on this continent with us, voting in somebody because he was going to get rid of the debt and he was going to make basically put everybody on a level playing field. They also didn't take into consideration that this guy was basically going to remove people from their land, resulting in the deaths of thousands, just so you could have more free real estate for a bunch of white people that are crowding in on each other because somehow they, believe me, living on the East Coast, there's plenty of land that I'm like, why didn't you take that? Why didn't you take that? And obviously, growing up in Los Angeles, I know why. But, you know, it's kind of like, those are the things that you think about when you do give people that full chance to vote. The problem, though, is that as time goes on and things get that much more dire and everybody is in that equation and everyone runs the risk of getting fucked... You can't go back to the way it was. You can't say, okay, you know what? We can't keep doing this. We can't keep letting all these people vote. Because then, guess who you start sounding like? You start rigged. You know, they should have closed the voting booths. I told them they should have closed them down, but they left them open so they could keep voting during Corona. And, you know, and I just don't buy into the idea that even if you're a dumb person, you shouldn't vote. Like, if you're uneducated, please do your best to be educated. And if
and I know
help
that's
those individuals,
a lot.
Great.
Yeah.
But believe me, it gets into a broader discussion that I need to leave and don't have time, I'm afraid.
I don't even have any remote interest in continuing this conversation.
All right, listeners. That's been episode 12. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Falling Middle Cast. Our co-hosts are Ryan Mancini and Sebastian Shug. Episodes are produced by Ryan Mancini and feature music by Kevin MacLeod. Check out our main series, Mars on Life, or listen to our other spinoff, Diet NIMBY, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.